That is Jerry Goldsmith and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, Frontiers, from the hit movie Star Trek First Contact. And what a way to start a podcast. Hi, this is Over 40 and Unapologetically Nerdy, and I'm your host, Tenfro, broadcasting a lovely Sunday afternoon after a magnificent meal, which you'll see the postings later on today in my Instagram. But in this episode, I'll be talking about stargazing in Tennessee. Who knew we were on the forefront of astronomical discovery? I'm going to be highlighting Jedediah Eastler, PhD, talking about dope Star Trek ships and collections, my own, because I'm nerdy with disposable income. I'm going to be talking about my latest Star Trek reads and why I'm interested in reading more of this genre. Going to talk about some Star Trek trivia, as well as read the prologue from my personal tales listeners. And I hope you enjoyed this episode and the prologue as much as I've enjoyed creating it. And thank you for listening. That's the introductory riff from Deep Space Nine, the main title by Dennis McCarthy. I've spent a greater part of this past week listening to, re-looking at these episodes in the beginning episodes, and I did not know how intertwined some of the storylines from The Next Generation, Voyager, the whole Borg conundrum. It was just it was an amazing and groundbreaking series in of its own self. It's just so sad that UPN and different networks did not see its worth until it, as well as Voyager, went off the air. But I'm glad I got have the opportunity and the means to be able to enjoy it, even these years later. What I've also done in my research for this week's episode is, I guess it's a continuation of last week's episode where I spoke in general about the great interstellar telescopes like Kepler and Hubble. I've used several of the images that have been transmitted back to Earth from the Hubble spacecraft. But then I started thinking about it, and I guess I was in between cases. I was like, well, if I'm going to, I started thinking about what the topic was and how I was going to construct my next blog post that I'm going to be actually moving behind the payment wall later on. But I am very, very much interested in sci-fi and how what we know now of the universe and who is contributing to it. I started looking up Earthbound telescopes, and I was greatly and happily discovered that there are 5 observatories right here in Tennessee. Had no idea. They are of the reflective or the refractor type. And I was like, what in a ham sandwich is that? I know there are radio telescopes, there are optical telescopes, and blah, blah, blah. But what exactly is that? So in the blog notes, I have a model of how it basically uses visual wavelengths and how it's translated into the great representation of stellar bodies and images, and how the computers actually interpret that information. The five telescopes I've actually have listed in in the blog notes. I did not know that there is a refractor, a reflector, which is a mirror-based, has a mirror-based optical system, right here in Tennessee. It's Clarence T. Jones, and right here. There's the Dyer in Brentwood that's associated with, of course, the Snooty Vanderbilt University. Initially, it started out as a refracting, but now it's a reflecting, using mirrors to create the opticals and the information, to translate the information. One of the coolest ones is right at Middle Tennessee University in Murfreesboro. It's a refractor, and the Uranodrome, the Naked Eye Observatory, has a scale-like model that looks pictorial-like Stonehenge. And for centuries or for years, everyone has thought that Stonehenge was not like not so much a alien communication device. It was ancient man's highly technical usage of visualizing the stars and doing star charts. So it may have had some advanced technological usage in prehistoric times, which is kind of cool. There's the Tamke or Tau Allen Observatory that is owned and operated by Roan State Community College right near Sweetwater, which is about an hour from me. And then there's the Cordell Lawrence, which is owned and operated by the University of the South in Suwannee, and it's also a refractor. All of this information is actually available online and in Wikipedia, and it is amazing how many cosmic discoveries that have been contributed to science and the fields of astrology and astrophysics right here in Tennessee. I think it's pretty amazing. I've also posted the Dyer Observatory stargazing day planner, if you will, for the month of March. There are opportunities to observe the stellar bodies for night on the night. So if you navigate to each individual observatory's website, you'll actually find where they have these stargazing parties that are all online. Most of, and all of actually, these observatories are have been closed to the public since COVID, the COVID pandemic, and there's no plans to open them up anytime soon. But there are opportunities to interact with other astronomy geeks like myself and the general public and actually learn a fair bit of astronomical information. And that's, it's also how it's a great lead-in to the next section, which I'm very proud of. This is also, March is Women History Month. And who are the Black astronomers that I've never heard of? And why haven't I and the rest of the reading and so-called educated public? This juggernaut, Dr. Jedediah Eisler, says in her TED Talk from 2015 that she first fell in love with the night sky as a little girl, and now she's an astrophysicist. She's actually a professor, assistant professor, currently working at Dartmouth College. She studies supermassive hyperactive black holes called blazons. She takes us trillions of kilometers from Earth. In her TED Talk, she takes us about trillion kilometers from Earth to introduce us to objects that can be 1 to 10 billion times the mass of the sun, in which she in which sometimes shoot powerful jets, streams of particles in our directions, and you get these amazing artist renditions of these phenomena. One serves as a backdrop of her TED Talk, and I've actually, again, included it in the full podcast notes for this episode. But so far, we also have a connection from an educational standpoint. Well, also because she's also African-American, and she's absolutely brilliant. She has a connection to my hometown. She was raised partially in upstate New York, but moved and graduated. I wonder where she went to high school. That's actually, I find that interesting. I'm going to have to find that out. Because she grew up in Virginia Beach and she would go on to obtain her Bachelor's of Science in Physics from Norfolk State. And then now that I live in Chattanooga, Tennessee, of course she gets her Master's of Science from Fisk University, Master's of Art in Physics at Fisk, right in Fisk is Memphis or Nashville, I can't remember. She goes on to get another master's, probably in astrophysics from Yale, and then she earns a PhD, the first African-American woman at Yale to gain a PhD in astrophysics. She goes on to get a Kavli Foundation Fellowship. She gets a TED National Science Fellowship, Ford Foundation Dissertation Fellowship. She's been extremely busy, and most recently, she serves on the transition team of President Joe Biden's team as for the transition from the lack of an administration previously to the current administration for NASA. I think it's wonderful that she's just been working her way in the background, probably not speaking to most anybody in intelligent anyways in the former lack of an administration, and she's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. It's astonishing to me that we're still making first here in the 21st century, but she's one of the ones being a nerd and being absolutely brilliant, cool again. Now she can actually, in the way her TED Talk was such that it makes science relatable, and it just seems like the current administration, to a certain extent, is more acceptable. It makes science more accessible, and there are people willing to listen and to try, at least on a basic level, understanding the importance of STEM and understanding the importance of giving people that look like her a clear voice and a piece and a place at the table. It would be great if we could see the administrations of NASA and all of the other commercially space technology-centered companies headed by people that are just as brilliant with a business sense, just as brilliant and just as interesting as Dr. Eisler. So my hat's off to Dr. Eisler and her team at Dartmouth. Go on, girl. You make us all proud. And now onto one of my favorite sections of Star Trek, the Star Trek corner. I follow several different accounts on Instagram, and one of my favorite, besides the Star Trek Discovery logs, has been this particular one called The Ships of Star Trek. This is a complete fans. Site or account that has no bearing or is not associated with CBS or the showrunners at all. This is also, there is a Ships of Star Trek podcast that I have not yet had the chance to listen to, but I do like the pictures that this particular creator posts. It's very Enterprise heavy, 1701 heavy. And then this week, some of the highlighted fandom are from Star Trek Online. This is by deviant artist Speckled Solace, and it's of the NCC 1701E. Also, there is Star Trek Voyager as it approaches the Caretaker Array. For those, this is by JetFreak7, also DeviantArt.com, brilliant artist and illustrator. But for those of you in nerddom, know of the whole story behind how Star Trek Voyager had just left Space Dock and left in response to the, oh, what do they call? Cardassian. I just watched this. It's a outsider. Chakotay and B'Elanna Torres were members of this sect. On the border of the Cardassia, they struck up a treaty with the Federation to give these colonies and these planets back to Cardassia. But the humanoids, or they did not want, the colonists didn't want to leave, so they started to fight back. They had support within the ranks of Starfleet, and they had spy who was Tuvok on one of their ships, and they were in the Badlands. In response to that, Voyager was on a secret mission to go and put a stop to the rebels, so to speak. And they were kidnapped by this Caretaker Array. The Caretaker was an entity that was looking for other entities so it could recreate itself before it succumbed to death. And they basically were snatched some 75,000 light years from the Alpha Quadrant and flung into the Delta Quadrant. They had to destroy the array, or supposedly had to destroy the array, before it landed in the hands of an enemy of these people. And one of the questions from the Star Trek, Ships of Star Trek, was, did Janeway make the right decision with the Caretaker Array when they basically destroyed it so it could not fall in the hands of the enemy? They so many weird violations of not only first contact but the Prime Directive. By her destroying that array, not letting it fall into the hands of the enemies of these lesser people, wasn't that a direct violation of the Prime Directive? They're not supposed to get involved with the internal and the internal affairs as well as the natural evolution of a species, because maybe on an ethical level, the enemy were truly an enemy. And they would have used that particular array to basically gain tremendous advantage in the Delta Quadrant. But suppose they were supposed to go that route. And also, by her destroying it, they couldn't get back to the Alpha Quadrant. But wasn't she in direct? I'm thinking she was. I think she was in a prime violation of the Prime Directive. And I think in one of the books that I'm going to, that's upcoming, that I'm reading, is they, I think she may, when they do get back to the Alpha Quadrant, she may actually get judged by it. But there's also all in the upcoming fan fiction about her fate and her team's fate that I think you're also going to enjoy. But I'm going to pause right there. Those are the only two postings, or my little ramblings about the Ships of Star Trek that I really wanted to go or to talk about this week. And it's great that it's apropos. One of the things that I actually got this week, because I'm a big old nerd with disposable income, I got a small Starship Voyager, as well as a Enterprise Class E, I believe it is, to add to my other growing collection of models. I also added the NX-01, even though I completely despise Enterprise with Scott Bakula. That ship is the bomb. It has like little lights and things. I haven't put any batteries in it because I know I would just press it all the time. But it's a pretty decent size model. And I also got the Discovery, another Galaxy-class starship. When you have... Oh, and also what you'll see in my Instagram post is the coolest thing that I did get is a Star Trek miniaturized... it has a model inside, but it's basically a Star Trek, the NC-1701, the first edition, and it is pretty cool. I know I'm not putting that billion-piece model together, but it's actually kind of a cool. I like the idea of the limited edition sticker that came with it, as well as the actual lunchbox itself. This, I have way too much time and disposable income at my disposal at this time, but those are some of the things that I actually purchased this week. And on to a cool part of the show, which I like to call Star Trek Trivia. I would like you to basically answer the following questions in the contact form at the end of the blog post. And the questions for this week are, what species uses transwarp conduits? Who started the war between the Borg and species 8472? And what is Voyager's ultimate goal? And I bet I should basically start telling you the answers to last week's questions. I think that would be helpful, don't you think? So I'm pulling up the February 28th Star Trek. I think I'm going to have to start putting those in a separate file. But here they are. The answers to last week's Star Trek trivia questions were, what is the duet the Doctor and Seven of Nine sang together? The answer to that is You Are My Sunshine. And that answer actually was in the YouTube post that I actually did in last week's blog post or podcast notes. What is the authorization code used by Captain Janeway to activate the self-destruct sequence? Is Janeway Pi-110? What was the Doctor's original purpose? He was an emergency medical hologram. Who says the line, arm the photonic cannons? That is the emergency command hologram. That's, again, the bald head doctors of design. And basically, what is the Doctor? He's basically a hologram. What an amazing way to start out this segment of the podcast with Wild Signals, a compilation from John Williams from the original soundtrack for Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was released in November of 1977. And this is my original publication or original posting called Listeners, and I hope you enjoy it. Fun fact, there are over 500 waterfalls located throughout the eastern portion of Tennessee, with the largest waterfall being Fall Creek Falls in the state park. Little known fact, a majority of these waterfalls actually reside on private property, not accessible to the public, and that are not managed by the Department of the Interior or the Department of Forestry. There are also 5 observatory of the astronomical kind located throughout the state that are owned and operated through the state university systems, community college, and private university systems. Another question. What do an astrophysicist and a quantum mechanic, formerly of NASA, eat for comfort food? Cup of noodles. Felicity walks back from the kitchen with 2 steaming cups. The electrified cups are a creation that resemble the styrofoam cups of the instant ramen noodle fame, but with a heating element to keep the contents warm, with a sealed top with a raised imprint of either the Enterprise model or other starships, with side to hold a lightsaber fashion chopsticks of R2-D2 that light up, either blue or red. This is what super nerds with unlimited disposable income can buy or create in their own technology lab. She walks back through the gardens, noting the beauty of the flowers and the trickling water. She pauses as she does several times a day, the enclosure as the waterfall cascades down the rocky face of the mountain to get to the running stream that runs below the connector bridge, and she inhales. She thinks to herself, we have to get some laps in that pool and then a nice soak in the natural heated pools. The water that was diverted from the hot springs was also a source of power to the complex. Everything was cycled and recycled. The steam was collected and regenerated into potable water, her eyes following the rivulets of water down the mountainside, breathtaking at this vantage point. Unbelievable, overwhelming, and she and her husband, Dahl, D-A-H-L, owned it. Shouldn't it be possible, but I'm glad it's us. She walks up behind her literal mountain man, Dahl Lundgren, a freighter of a man with wild mane of strawberry blonde hair, a matching beard, and mischievous violet blue eyes, disconcerting to all who did not know him. He was of Dutch extraction, but immigrated from South Africa during the unrest of the apartheid years, spending much of his formative years in boarding school in Sweden, leaving his parents in the monastery in Nepal, where they contemplated the Buddhist tenets period. Then coming to America on a student visa for this final work on his first PhD in quantum mechanics, where he met the afroed, bespeckled geek from Tennessee and North Georgia. She was a wonder kid that had graduated from Georgia Tech at the age of 16 and had been invited to a Caltech program for astrophysics and quantum mechanics. He was looking over her shoulder as the brilliant 18-year-old wrote recursive algorithms and accompanying code on the IBM supercomputer. Amazing She jumped and taken aback by the massive long-haired man standing in front of her. She narrows her eyes. Have you taken a wrong turn from the USC football field? Yeah, unless you think they will miss a 2 left feet dork from South Africa. I think I'm going to be good and I'm in the right place. And she laughs in spite of herself, period. She wanted him to speak more because of the musical quality of his accent and finding an unexpected kindred spirit in the halls of Caltech. That initial collaboration led to a first place prize in the newly created Degrassi grant, which was $50,000, and then several subsequent scientific prizes and discoveries. Theirs would become a lifelong connection over science, curiosity of the universe, and science fiction obsession. All the big names at JPL, NASA, the military, not just in the US, but internationally, Caltech, MIT, Google Alphabet, Macintosh, Envision, even Elon Musk came a-knocking, but the oppressive nature in a typical academic or corporate structure was not at all appealing to them. They would become lifelong consultants. They had the flexibility to pick and choose who they work for and what they choose to pursue. Then 11 years ago, while they were doing work at Rhone State, the Tau observation outside of Sweetwater, they would rediscover a box of their Star Trek memorabilia. And as they unpacked it, they noticed the lid resembled a Borg cube. There were stills of several starships and several jump drives with numbered starships and all the Enterprise forms and models. They looked at each other, pulling out and inserting each drive with the computer beeping and whirling, and each ending of the processes, there would be displayed a subsequent letter. Each algorithm running successfully with a final tally of 250,000 bitcoins, not USD, but bitcoins, worth a whopping $15 at the beginning of the craze, to a breathtaking $114 per Bitcoin, and at that time they had a cool $29 million sitting on jump drives in a Borg cube memorabilia box. They would continue working at Tau and the university for another 2 years, acquiring more of the elusive currency, and then right around its outrageous peak at $40,000 per Bitcoin, they would take out several million dollars of cash in U.S. currency, and they would start to build a life of in seclusion. They had hiked the waterfalls of East Tennessee during this time and had staked out the site on the Ford farm and basically 3D printed on site a replica of the Sears Kit House, the Magnolia. They would excavate and construct a telescope and massive server in the caves, which were former ore mining operations that had long since played out. With the direction of a cave diver from Bali, they would track the source for miles into the mountain range to parts of the tributaries that formed a massive underground lake, but the rest serving as the unexpected falls cascading to the creek at the back of the old farmhouse. They would build hurricane impact windows and girders that would be constructed over the connecting bridge that led to the entrance of the cave. or side of the cave anyways, but was protected from the cascading falls that ran alongside it. The workspace would be a combination of living quarters, an amazing bathroom, housing the supercomputer server, and lab to process all of the data coming from their personal radio telescope. Because of its depth in the mountain, the unit stayed a cool 59 degrees, perfect for the server optimal server operation and their 2,000 bottle wine. The professional geeks, as they were called, would request and be granted to be adjunct professors at Roan State Community College, but their work would continue at the Batman-style technological grotto, and together they were free to explore the world from their super gaming chairs by tapping into the satellite and cameras as the worldwide government spied on their citizens. They also began to do further research and create calculators to tune out the universal noise, specifically to increase the sharpness of video and audio quality. Several patented technologies they would create, but that would be licensed to everything from the Pixel to iPhone to Sony TVs, film, and some of the extraordinary special effects that they enjoy in their scientific movies. Governments, in particular the Chinese and Russians, were very interested in using the enhanced version of the technology to spy on its citizens and the rest of the world, but they never could quite get the technology, and they would attempt to steal it over and over again. However, included in the technology itself were several Trojan and self-destruct phases that were incorporated into the programs. The perfect technology built by the ultimate hackers. One of the programs sends out a tracker device, so not only did they shut down the system when you attempted to break the encryption, it sent out a beacon to the authorities to let them know exactly who had stole their technology. It was rumored that it was such a device or program that had crippled the Iranian government for several weeks and released by one such attempt by HiTech.4, which is the spy program that they install within their software, was unleashed. So as the automatic doors open and close, she approached the broad muscle back of her nerd partner, squinting at the display and setting down the cup of noodles. He distractedly picks up and taps the screen and takes a large bite and slurps up the soup. The Chinese are at it again. The lights are off in the Xinjiang province. Check it out. And he brings up a Google Earth scene, but real time, on the wall monitor, zooming in with vertigo-inducing speed to the cameras in what appears to be some governmental office with technicians all running around frantically and monitors all with snow. There's no audio, but there's simultaneously the Chinese trade guy, Haywire, but the Chinese trading platform, is going haywire when it plummets almost 2,000 points before trading is also suspended. Felicity then yells, "Thieving pieces of shit, that's what they get." "Alrighto," he says in his South African lilting language. "They'll untangle and be up in cheating in no time." Felicity's response is a guttural harumph, and a string of Klingon curses follow. "Before you go out on a blood feud, this is some data I've been working through from the Tau telescopes and the other statewide telescopes, and we've been looking at the data as a whole, but we started noticing a repeating pattern on several bands. When I analyzed the data, this is what the computer created. And now when I add that recursive algorithm, I get this on the screen. And what comes forth is a ghostly outline of an image. Felicity sets down her captain, her cup and chopsticks mid-chew. What am I looking at? What's the source? Dahl says, given the degradation of the signal calculated, some 40,000 light years from here is what we think. Felicity, the Aquarius cluster? Okay. So we isolate the specific wavelengths and add the additional algorithms running on a loop processor, and we can project the image. Wait, what the fuck? This is an image from outer space? Some first contact encounters of the third kind shit? And Dahl says, yeah, I know. Do you think we're the only ones that know? Felicity says, I don't think so, but we can't tell anyone yet. Let's work on this a little more. And that's how I'm going to end this episode, as mystical as I started it. That is The Visitors by Entitled, special edition from the original soundtrack of The Encounters of the Third Kind. And that's just kind of apropos for all of this episode and my dabble into sci-fi. Stay tuned for later publication of the next episode, where I do a deeper dive into the backgrounds of these astrophysical nerds and all they learn from listening and to the first contact with beings from the other side or from a completely different galaxy. How they went from Nowheresville to extraterrestrial communicators. And as always, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I've enjoyed creating it. And I hope you will stay tuned as I continue to dabble in sci-fi fiction. I mean, isn't it about time? I'm just saying. Navigate to shipabagadicks.com and use my promo code TIFROGOTJOKES. To get a percentage off of your order, navigate to Chatterbooks to pick up all of my Star Trek fiction. And I didn't mention it so much more on this episode because it's kind of illegal for me to read a whole bunch from the book itself. But the Star Trek fiction that I'm reading is absolutely amazing. I actually like the theme and how they played into the Borg, the ex-Borg, and the Borg are basically fighting for existence. And the Federation trying to stomp them out goes completely against that. And it's coming up to an end where I think they're going to have to see what's more important. Stomping out a whole race, a species, or protecting the Federation. That's some heavy crap, but I think Jean-Luc Picard, the rest of the new cast of the Enterprise, as well as Hugh, because he makes an appearance and will be assisting in this new war with the Collective. And as always, I hope you will enjoy this episode as much as I've enjoyed creating it. And until next time, bye, y'all.